Creative and Curious, a weekly podcast made for creative seekers who are compelled to let your inner artist reign free. Here we explore the mystery of how creating makes us better humans and artists. I'm Marika, and welcome to today's discoveries. Welcome to episode one of Creative and Curious. I'm so excited to have you here with me today. And I want to start by sharing my own self-taught journey with you. Since it's the first episode, I'd like to share about myself so we can get to know each other better. And I think it could be helpful for you and your journey as well. Personally, I had a lot to unlearn. Then I had to relearn a whole bunch more. And I guess that might be helpful to you too. So let's begin. It's 2001, and I'm 27 years old, in my living room, staring at my bookshelf on the verge of an epiphany that would eventually become a foundational shift in my life. I had just read a couple of books that combined led me to that pivotal point. One was Multiple Intelligences by Howard Gardner, and the other was a biography of Frida Kahlo. I was in graduate school at the time, studying adult education, and I was learning something that brought me relief and joy in those studies. Intelligence is fluid, meaning changeable. It really isn't fixed. It isn't something we're necessarily born with and stuck with for life. It can change and shift. You can be smart even if somebody tells you you're not, because intelligence can change. You can gain intelligence. You can get smarter. More than that, after I read Multiple Intelligences, I was thrilled to learn that what schools generally deem as smart and intelligent is only just a fraction of the many different ways of knowing or intelligences that exist in human potential. And in his book, Howard Gardner outlined 8 intelligences. Later on, he would add a 9th too. They were these: logical and mathematical, verbal and linguistic, interpersonal, your ability to manage relationships, intrapersonal, the ability to know yourself and your emotions, kinesthetic. This is the intelligence of being an athlete or a dancer. Your musical ability. And then finally, the spatial and visual intelligence, which is the ability to understand space and visual information and their nuances. A lot of artists could be considered very intelligent here. So this blew my mind. It gave me a beautiful sense of relief for a couple of reasons. First of all, schools and its measures were not a mirror for me and my intelligence. My grades or performance at an institution did not reflect my potential or who I was. All they really did was measure me by fractions, just looking at my verbal skills, my math and logic skills, and a lot of ability to memorize. I did actually do fairly well with these measures, but that actually confused me because I didn't value them in me. I didn't think they were that interesting. And looking back, subconsciously, I must have believed there had to be more to me than just my verbal and math skills and my ability to memorize. More interesting to me, musical and visual spatial skills were considered forms of intelligence. And I grew up in a household where smart was important. And I'm talking school smart. So according to Howard Gardner, there are other ways to be smart, and the arts were included. Not only that, but they were fluid too. You could learn to get smart at these intelligences. You can get better at them. And that is delightful. That's a wondrous kind of hope. And at heart, none of these intelligences were inherently more important than the other. They were just different ways of knowing and excelling and practicing being human. And that felt right to me. I felt like I was finally really learning key pieces to find my purpose and discovering who I am in all these intelligences. Then I picked up the biography of the very famous painter Frida Kahlo, and it was the first part of her life that struck me the most. Did you know that as a child, Frida Kahlo did not show any artistic genius, and she was not well known for her artistic ability? She might have liked to sketch, but in fact, the book made it sound like she had no interest in the arts as a child and through high school. maybe she could have been good at theatrical arts and performance. And then when she was 18 or 19, she was in a horrible trolley accident in Mexico City. A handrail impaled her pelvis. She was permanently injured after that accident and suffered from chronic pain and complications for the rest of her life. And she was immediately hospitalized and bedridden for months. She was wrapped in casts, unable to move when she started to paint. It was a very life-affirming choice given the circumstances, and likely it just gave her ease and peace. She painted because she really didn't have a lot of options. She couldn't go anywhere. And she painted because she needed something to do. And that was another epiphany for me. She was not a natural born genius. One of my most favorite artists was not a natural born genius. When she was a child, she wasn't considered an amazing artist. No one told her she was talented. She painted through her injury and she got better because she kept painting. And she kept painting because it fed her soul and it probably helped her heal. It helped her express herself as well. And it helped her manage the lifelong pain that accident had caused her. So her genius wasn't born at birth. If anything, it was seeded with that accident. And it was born after she committed to the practice of painting. I was floored. This was shocking to me. Talent and genius are not permission to practice art. Let me say that again, because I think that's really key. Talent and genius are not permission to practice art. They're not permission at all. In fact, maybe talent, maybe genius don't exist, or at least they don't exist the way that we believe they do. Our society wants us to believe that we do. So I finally understood that it really didn't matter that no one had told me that I would be an artist. No one had been blown away by my creative efforts when I was 10 years old. My art teachers in middle and high school had sort of nodded passively at my projects. I had loved one of my college level art classes, but I wasn't convinced that I belonged there because I clearly lacked greatness. And when I look back on that, I don't think anybody in the class had greatness. I think we all just really liked what we were doing. But greatness is a lot to ask of any beginning artist. Yet somehow I had decided you must be great in order to even start. That's not true. The truth is entirely different. I actually have the most important prerequisite for creating art and even deciding to be an artist. I have the desire to create. I just want to do it. I have a creative impulse that I actually have no control over that keeps knocking on me from the inside and making me feel restless until I let it express itself. It isn't a talent and it's not a genius. It's just desire. I just want to do it. The true gift is your desire to create. Now, let me say that again. The true gift, the true talent, or the true genius, the true gift is your desire to create. If you want to do it, that is your gift, and that is your permission. That is the seed of genius or talent, if they exist. And that desire is what's going to motivate you to practice and create and get better and develop mastery. It works that way. Desire is the first thing. And I'm incredibly grateful for this gift because back then when I was looking at those books and I contemplated this idea of multiple fluid intelligences, the ability to become smarter and all of them, the nature of talent and genius of Frida Kahlo, the one thing that I knew I had was that impulse. I want to create. And these stories gave me the permission I needed to let not what others thought or measured, but my desire guide me. So I'm guessing if you're listening, you have the desire too. And if that's true, that's what you need to pay attention to. Check in with the other self-talk about if you deserve to be there, if you deserve to be at the canvas. Do you say that you aren't creative or you're just not that good? These things simply aren't true. You're just going to get better the more that you practice at it. So I embraced the idea that if I wanted to be creative or be an artist, I had to have a creative practice. It didn't matter if I was bad at it or I didn't like what I made because I finally understood that the more that I practiced, the better I'd get. I just had to commit to it. So I knew I needed a plan. The plan came very quickly for me because it was all an epiphany. It was all in a flash and an instant in this total shift in my mind. There were some things that I did, even without thinking too much about it, that I think are kind of helpful to unpack here. So, of course, the first thing I needed to do was decide what I wanted to practice. What was my medium? And I think everyone has at least one medium, and it can be whatever you feel the most comfortable or curious about in expressing yourself. So it could be painting or writing or music or quilting or mosaics. And sometimes you have more than one medium. I definitely am a painter. I definitely have some writing skills, and I like to cook. But if you put me in front of a sewing machine, it's a complete and total disaster. So there might be a sort of a repertoire of mediums that you like to express yourself with. And usually it's obvious when you find it because it makes you curious, because you want to learn more about that medium. And that's what motivates you. That's what keeps you practicing, right? So I knew that I wanted to paint. And this was interesting because before that, I hadn't even let the idea that I could be a visual artist in my psyche. I had been told that I could be a good writer, but writing was becoming dangerous because I had been told I had some talent. I felt like then I always had to prove my talent. The thing about painting is I felt like I had no talent and I had nothing to prove. So it was a very safe place, and I was curious about it, right, too. So it was a very safe place for me to decide to have a creative practice because I didn't have any of these preconceived, well, I must be good at this even to start kind of things. Where writing, I had that. So that was a surprise that painting was coming up as this thing that I wanted to do. And it was coming up from a very wordless place that I didn't really question. I think in some ways it was Frida Kahlo and just the fact that she didn't really paint before her accident. And I thought, well, I'm 27, 28. I can paint too. I don't have to have shown that talent. So since I knew that I wanted to paint, the next natural step was to figure out what kind of painting, and watercolor rose to the top quickly and easily. I just thought it was cool. Some of the effects and the cool things that you can do with watercolor, I had no idea how to do them, but I definitely wanted to learn about it more. The next thing to do was to decide how to learn. And again, this was another obvious step in the flash, and books for a few reasons. First of all, it was before YouTube, so I didn't have anything easily accessible online. Second, I'm just a big reader. I often will go straight to books if I'm curious about anything and read a few books about it. It just works for me. But books are also cheap, and especially going to the library, that's cheap too. And it's flexible. I didn't have to be on a schedule. I didn't have to go to a class every week and figure out how to fit that into my life. I could just pick up the books when I had the time to pick up the books. And it made it easy and accessible for me. I also like to learn by doing. And even if I really don't know what I'm doing, oftentimes that's exactly how I learn. I just kind of dive in and start doing things. And so the first question I had at the books, of course, was what supplies do I need? What's the recommended stuff that I need to buy here so that I could just start painting? I basically started, grabbed some photographs and started to just paint from those photographs. And I'd read the books in between painting sessions to find tips and tricks that would help me get better. I didn't ever follow a painting tutorial step by step because that's just not my style. It might be your style, but it's definitely not my style. I'm just not that good at following directions. I'm good at giving them. I've been a teacher for a very long time. I can give you directions if you'd like, but it doesn't go well the other way around. It's interesting to note that I didn't consider painting classes at all. And that's not necessarily advice for you to avoid classes. Classes can be really wonderful catalyst to your style and knowledge. You probably might even learn faster than books and doing it on your own. But I had grown up with this preconceived idea that art classes could be dangerous. And it was really subconscious because I really didn't even think I should take an art class. I just went directly to books. You see, I grew up in a house with all my mom's paintings on the wall. She wanted to be an artist before she had kids. And there was one painting in our home that I can see so clearly. It was a field of cave painting bisons painted in neutral colors. And it was pretty big. It was probably like 4 by 4 or 4 by 5 feet. And she had done a bunch of historical research on cave paintings. And many of the bisons were painted to look like the originals from the caves. Then she took this painting to her art class critique circle. And there, one by one, every person in that critique circle told her all the reasons why they didn't like her painting. Until the last one said to her, "Well, I like that one right there." To which she replied, "Would you like me to cut it out and give it to you?" And then she never returned to her art class, and she pretty much gave up painting after that. It was really as if she was asking, "Would you like to cut my heart out and give it to you?" Because that's what they had all done. They had all crushed her heart with that thoughtless negativity. And that's what that story, when my mom told me it, taught me about art classes, that they can crush your heart. They can especially destroy you if you are delicate, vulnerable, you suffer from imposter syndrome, you have a strong inner voice that insists you aren't creative, or you believe that talent is born and not self-made, and that good art is only art that pleases everyone. All those thoughts can be self-destructive to your creative journey, and all those thoughts are prominent when you first start out on your journey. So it's important, if you do choose a teacher and a class, that you know that the class will be in your best interest and that the teachers will treat you and your work at the stage and place that it is at the time. In the beginning, nurturing and supporting coaching is all you need. You don't need a lot of criticism. You need time and a lot of positive strokes to create an armor that can hear criticism without taking it personally, and even identify what is in the criticism that is helpful, informative, and just getting rid of the useless, mean-spirited stuff. And this doesn't come naturally, especially in our society. This kind of armor, it's a muscle that you need to strengthen. It's a confidence that you need to grow inside of yourself. And the more that you paint, the closer you'll get to it. And the more that you learn to accept yourself through painting, the closer you're going to get to it. So the great thing, of course, about books is they don't talk back and they don't tell you what you did wrong. They don't crush your heart and they don't critique. So with books, I could read and pursue and learn about materials and supplies without a critical voice in my head telling me the right way, or without an art teacher implying that there's a correct way to approach art, or that I'm cute for trying, but not really worth taking seriously. I want to pause here for a second and state that I do believe in the value of getting opinions from others when you're ready to hear it, and finding people you trust and admire that do it is an important part of your learning. The key is trust and mutual admiration, and when you are ready. But in those early days, when I was a baby artist, just getting my painting wings on with a fragile ego that was only just beginning to hope that practice trumped talent, I didn't need to be in any environment that might discourage me. And that was more important to me than critique that pushed me to grow. I was painting for myself and not for everyone else. The main point here is that I created a safe and comfortable place for myself to learn. With books and the right supplies, I painted from photographs while grabbing time when I had it. And that's key. Creativity needs safety. It needs love and vulnerability and a nurturing community to become strong enough to weather whatever critiques come its way. Those baby phases, when we're just learning and you have a long way to go, they need to be protected. So that's the important thing, creating that safe and comfortable space. And that's something to think about, is what is a safe and comfortable space for you when you're developing your creative practice? And knowing it, knowing that it's the safe and comfortable place, puts you in a position of power, because then when you're ready to move outside of it, you know that's what you're doing. You know that this might be a little scary, and you can put that armor on. You can decide whether you want to take in the judgment or not. And you know where to go when you need to go back to safety, when you need to go back to comfort. There was another benefit to the isolated practice that I didn't expect, but I did develop my own critique muscles. I became the critic of my own work and I pushed at it. I decided I was going to paint for myself and not for anyone else. And that meant if I didn't like it, I had to improve it. And that made me responsible for my own improvements. Sometimes I failed at improvements, but I always learned. So I became a better critic by reading and doing research about composition. I looked at a lot of paintings and I tried to find what I liked in them. I experimented and asked questions. I learned that student grade pigments were nothing compared to professional quality, and half of the problems that I had with my work were the quality of the materials, not the painting itself. I learned all sorts of techniques and picked up the ones that I thought would help me the most and set me on my own creative journey in the direction and vision of my own work. In this way, I was responsible for what I created and I was responsible for making it better. I learned to paint past this is okay, an okay piece of work, past that feeling of just sort of being surprised by what I'm capable of. I learned to paint past that into the unknown places where your work starts to move into more interesting directions. I told myself, I know this can be better, and I stared hard at my work trying to define what I needed, and I submitted to small experiments with my painting and worried less that I would mess it up. So the value in creating your own critique muscle is that it also helped me create my own sense of style. And I think that's something that many people, including formally trained artists, really struggle with, a personal voice. In one way, this is a symptom of being trained by someone with their own opinions and style and whose work you like and want to copy. They'll always use their own filter or preferences to give you advice, but it may not be the advice that will help your own style flourish, that will help you learn your own vision for your work. So I think it's worth, even if you do work with a teacher, that you take a first stab at being a critic and deciding what could make your work better. Start to learn to trust your own judgment. Make notes about your work and then ask others if you feel the need about what they think about your work, but only people you trust and whose work you admire and when you're ready for it. So no matter how you decide to learn, here's some tips I think that could help shape a positive experience for you. Like I said, don't let others decide if you are good enough to be in the game of creating. Everyone's good enough who has the desire to do it. The work is yours. Own it, love it, work on it, and trust yourself while you're doing it. Share it when you're ready and confident to hear feedback, good or bad, but check in and make sure that you're ready. If people don't like it, learn from it and move on. Don't give your power away to a group of people that really don't understand what you're trying to accomplish. Don't let others take you out of the game of creating. And so this brings me to being satisfied and unsatisfied with your work. Because I think being unsatisfied is a natural part of growing and learning, and it's the more exciting part of the creative process than being satisfied. It's a signal that you're ready to commit and get better. So initially, I was pretty happy with some of the attempts I made. I was impressed with my painting that I could actually make a fish look like a fish or a flower and a building, a building. The colors were sometimes really nice too, but it really wasn't enough for me. Painting from photographs was good technical work and sometimes I did fairly well. But beyond that, it just didn't feel like it was expressing me anymore. It felt limited. And that part, the fact that I wasn't expressing me, was what was bothering me. So I knew I had to change something. At the time, I started thinking a lot about the doodling that I used to do in notebooks in college and at meetings. First, because I think if you're a doodler, clearly you have the desire to create, and it's an early sign that you might be an artist. And also because some of it I thought was kind of interesting that what I used to draw. I used to do these like portraits with stylized shapes locked together and that would kind of create the illusion of hair. I also incorporated these shapes in some of my art projects at school from as young as middle school. It was something that I just seemed to really like to experiment with. And I was beginning to wonder what it would be like if I brought them into my painting. So I tried an experiment. And remembering those doodles and projects, I started painting without a clear intent, and I worked on shapes and color variation that were kind of within those organic shapes that I used to doodle a lot. I also decided to focus on what I could do and not worry what was hard, what I hadn't quite mastered with watercolor yet. I didn't like the paint to touch because watercolor will bleed really easily. So I let the shapes kind of sit in white space between them, which gave me more control, but it also became part of my style. I ended up with a painting that in my mind looked like a woman. It was red and yellow and a silhouette. And it was original. I had never seen anything like it before. It wasn't world-shaking, but I liked it. And that was a lot different than my other paintings. So I framed it and I put it on the living room wall. It was the first painting I liked enough to display. And it was the first painting that I felt like expressed something about me. So I think that's key. If you're unsatisfied, that's absolutely fantastic. It means you're ready to grow. So what can you do to invite growth and change into your work? What do you need to shift a little bit? You could think about the drawing and the doodling that you did when you were younger and what you were drawn to when you were a child or what you played with or collected that might make their way into your work. As you're finding your style, focus on what you can do, what you're doing well, and work with that because that can be key to your style, to the unique way that you're going to express yourself when you focus on what you can do. You won't be able to master all the skills right away, but it's such a great experiment to just see and accept and embrace what you're good at. So as the years went by, my house became full of frame paintings. Yeah, the weird thing was I never called myself an artist. I painted because I needed to paint. I was compelled to. It calmed me. It kept me curious and creative. But I never thought of myself as an artist. I had a job. I was a teacher. I was faculty at a college. I was an educator. I had a very respectable profession. I was a mother. I was a wife. But no way was I an artist. And eventually people started to notice the paintings and ask about them when they came over. When people asked if they could buy it or if it was for sale, my response was always that my work was way too personal and meaningful to sell. And I would wiggle, like I would literally wiggle with discomfort and change the subject. And for the longest time, that was the artist that I was, someone who created but didn't sell my work and couldn't claim the term artist and could barely talk about my painting. Artist, in my mind, was an elite term that was used for the chosen, talented few that could make a living, sell their work, and basically breathe an identity as an artist. That was definitely not me. And I think that's a bunch of BS, really. I wish I'd embraced this idea of being an artist much sooner. I believe we all have an artist, a creator, that wants to express itself by doing and practicing. And we are all artists. In fact, I'm not sure from a big picture perspective what the difference is between an artist and being a human. They seem interlocked. It seems essential to create. Creating and what we learn from committing to this process makes us better at life and at art. And if we drop all the self-deprecating BS around it, you can just amplify the benefits. You're an artist. Own it. What are you telling yourself about your identity and your need to create? Do you do things like call yourself a dabbler or a hobbyist? And what happens if for one day or one week you tell yourself, I'm an artist? How would that change your day? How would that change your week? Try it out. So here are some of the key points from this story. If you didn't already figure it out, you don't have to be talented or a genius to be creative. If you're compelled, if you have that creative desire, that's your permission. It's what will move you to practice and get better. It's what's going to keep you curious. And you can always get better at it because remember, intelligence is fluid. You just practice, you get better. Create a safe and practical space for learning that's customized for your needs. Don't invite criticism into your work until you practice enough and are really ready to hear positive and negative from people you trust and admire, and you're ready to discern the difference and what you need out of that. Experiment and get in touch with your inner child. What did you doodle or think about when you were younger? And how can that inspire your work now? And focus on what you can do and play with that. Don't worry so much about what you can't. That will come with practice. But when you focus on what you can do, that is the avenue towards finding your style, your true self. And own your identity as a creator and artist. No one can take it away. Being an artist makes you a better human and therefore the world a better place. So start there. You're just making the world better being an artist. And that, my friends, is the best advice I can give you from my experience becoming a self-taught artist. Have fun with it. Try it out. Play. And let me know how it goes. I'm so curious where this might take you. And finally, here's a little inspiration for you. It's one of my favorite poems by Rumi. It's called Where Everything is Music. We have fallen into the place where everything is music. The strumming and the flute notes rise into the atmosphere. And if the whole world's harp should burn up, there will still be hidden instruments playing, playing. This singing art is sea foam. The graceful movements come from a pearl somewhere on the ocean floor. Poems reach up like spindrift and the edge of driftwood along the beach, wanting, wanting. They derive from a slow and powerful root that we cannot see. Stop the words now. Open the window in the center of your chest and let the spirits fly in and out. Spending this time with me and for spreading the word about Creative and Curious. You can find me here every Thursday with new thoughts and insights on creativity, curiosity, and life. Tell me what you think. Please email me your comments and questions at marika@marikarenke.com. And if you feel inclined, leave a review. They really do mean the world to me, and they'll help this podcast reach people just like you. And the best thing that you can do, keep creating. Thanks again.